Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. It's episode 38. It's getting dangerously close to episode 40. Episode 40. Who knows what's great about that? It's a round number. That's probably what it is. Something great might happen in episode 40. Actually, I know what's happening in episode 40 and it is great. Anyway, back to the day. We need to live in the day. This is episode 38. And in this episode, I speak to Lee Posner, who has a new collection of poetry coming out, a wonderful book called Arboretum. Now, I need to tell you several important things. The first important thing I need to tell you, and it probably is the most important thing, is that Arboretum launches on Monday the 17th of October at 17 Torrey Street at 6 p.m. So that's 17th of October, 17 Torrey Street here in Wellington at 6 p.m. So yes, it'll be awesome. Be there. The second thing is that Chris Holdaway of Compound Press, Lee and I talk about a journal that he started. That journal is called Minarets. You can find links to Minarets and Compound Press on the Googles, but you can also use our show page, which is betterrednz.wordpress.com. So yeah, come on over and have a look at that. The other thing is that Arboretum starts with a French, bit of French, it's very cultured, and Lee just sent me the translation of that. It's not included in the book, which I think is kind of cool. There's interesting things and issues about translation. So yeah, what's that French thing? This is like a special, if you're listening to this, you get a special insight. So what that phrase says is that death, as it fills the sky like sun, will make the flowers of their devising bloom. Beautiful thing. So Arboretum is amazing. When I first got it, I was a little bit frightened. I'm always frightened of poetry. I'm always a little bit frightened that I won't be smart enough for poetry. And we talk a little bit in the podcast about what challenges some types of poetry can set for the reader. And what happened for me is that I saw a few allusions to classical characters and I saw the French quote and I was like, oh no, oh no. But what was wonderful is that as I read it, I realized there were other pleasures to be had apart from meaning. And that, you know, even though I didn't know exactly who these people were, some of the meaning kind of sifted through. And Lee talks a lot about that. And I think that, is one of the best things about this book, is that it is possibly a different type of poetry than what we perhaps conventionally publish in New Zealand, but I think it's very exciting and there's a lot of pleasure to be had in it. So yes, I hope you enjoy my chat with Lee, and thank you very much. Episode 40. Woo. Okay, so I am here with Lee Posner. How are you, Lee?
Good, thanks.
Awesome, that's great. Thanks. And we're here sort of on the occasion of your new collection. How are we calling this thing? Like, is it a collection of poetry? Is it a novel? Is it a grouping of, how do you call it?
I think you'd call it a collection of poetry. Mm-hmm. Although I suppose collections of poetry these days are much more themed, or they have a kind of arc. Mm-hmm. Or some guiding principle. So, yeah, I mean, we're still called a collection, but in the old days, a collection was just like a grouping of things you wrote during a certain period of occasional poems, and maybe now it's more coherent as a book. So I would say it's definitely, you know, has quite a specific conceptual arc and everything, and, mm-hmm. and it's trying to do certain things as a whole.
So, yeah. Cool. So it is called Arboretum, is that correct?
Arboretum.
And it's launching on the Monday, the 17th of October at 17 Torrey Street at 6 p.m.
6 p.m, yep.
That sounds like a really exciting thing. It's really nice to have something that's so, it feels like it's bursting and getting ready to, you know, explode. It'll be wild. So just a little bit about the legacy or the history of the work. Some of it has appeared already in print, hasn't it?
A handful of, oh right, that's it. So there'll be a handful of poems in a few journals here and there, but also Chris Holdaway of Compound Press published the title poem of what is now this full book, which is also called, you're right, Arboretum, as a chapbook, mm-hmm. Alongside Steve Toussaint's chapbook in 2014, which is a really exciting event. And so yeah, that title poem comprises the first of four sections in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, yeah, this is the full thing.
Can you, I mean, just going off track slightly, how did that sort of collaboration come about? Like, Compound Press make beautiful books, and they make quite particular, they seem to showcase quite particular types of poetry that is extremely exciting. And I was just wondering, how did that come about?
I don't hugely know. I mean, I know Chris was working away in Auckland with exciting people, and had he had the journal. The name is probably going to escape me because I'm doing this now.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't prep you, of course, which would have been kind, but you know.
It would be really helpful if I could tell you that journal's name. But anyone who knows Chris Holdaway and Compound Press will know of the journal that was going for 4 or 5 issues. And so Steve, because I had a hard time I have a hard time full stop getting poems published in journals, I asked Steve if he would be interested in publishing Arboretum, the long poem, the title poem, on his blog, which he did very kindly and generously. And then thereupon, Chris Holdaway contacted me saying, hey, how would it be if we did your chapbook and Steve's chapbook? And of course, I was thrilled. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it was a beautiful publication. And I mean, it must have been amazing to work with someone who cares so much about, you know, the work, but also the kind of artifact of the object that the work sits in.
Totally right, yeah. And Chris above all holds both things really well, the metaphysical and the physical side of this equation. He cares deeply and does great things.
Amazing. So Arboretum, the new work, which will come out next week. It's very soon, isn't it?
Yeah, 9 days.
Oh my goodness, crikey. Woo, it's exciting. Do you want to talk a little bit about, like, some people don't like sort of talking about what the book is, or some of the themes or that sort of thing. Do you mind talking a little bit about what it is as a work?
Yeah, for sure. Maybe, because I know you might ask me this as well, it might make sense to just discuss the general way it came about, like, as a...
Yeah, that would be great. Collection. That would be really great.
Just like almost every poet ever, like, I guess, I don't know, in recent memory, I suppose, like, the first book is kind of... takes a long time, and for me, as I imagine, for most people, it's... like you have, I mean, in my case, literally, and probably most people as well these days, like you have a master file of things that are acceptable. Like these things I like and I'd like to share with people, and they're in my quote unquote first book. This is a collection. It has no shape as such. It's just a collection of things that are good enough or whatever. And the bottom keeps dropping out. You know, you look back a few months later and Father Time does his beautiful work and tells you it's shit. And you're like, get rid of that. And then you put it in some file. I'll save this for him. And then in the future, of course, that disappears, and that's okay. So over time, you know, this collection was moving along with the cursor of time, and eventually started taking shape. And it was when I was writing, I had one of those eureka moments in the bathtub,
which is
so perfect and cliche, where I started writing the pieces that ultimately became the title poem, it just started kind of getting a backbone, and then once I became slowly more conscious of what was going on, I was writing into that space, and things were developing, and I'd say maybe the oldest poem in it was maybe from 2008 or 2009, and then I well and truly finished it in August of 2013, so... Mm. Yeah, again, it's that classic story of years to kind of formulate this first book, and then the next couple, you know, were kind of year-long engagements with particular things, and much more of like, I guess the second book, things you are much more coherently working on from the start or something. And as for the theme, it also came, one of the main themes, main conceptual frameworks, which gives the book its title, came serendipitously, I guess, When some of these poems, the oldest ones, in fact, one definitely was from 2008, and I had given this collection when it was somewhere along in the formulation of what it was going to become, but still a few years before 2013, and I sent it to a colleague from grad school, and he in a single four syllable word dismissed the entire book. And it was so brutal, but at the time I was, you know, really willing and able to take that kind of pain, because I was having plenty of pain for a long time about my own writing and the value of it, and if I was ever going to be good and all that, and so it was a, you know, it was a tough blow. But he said something in it, and I'm not going to bother trying to repeat the exact phrase, but when he was dismissing it, he was dismissing a lot of it with the word atavistic, as in like echoing earlier generations and outmoded forms or something. So something that, in its application, in the sense that is kind of outmoded and irresponsible or something. And a lot of people will be upset to think that anyone should worry about the approval or being a responsible poet as such. I mean, there's so much heat generated in whether and how art should deal with like political issues and social issues. In this case, it was artistic issues, I'd say, but artistic issues directly relating to our vision and understanding of the world as 21st century humans making art. And so anyway, getting to the theme, let me see how I can do this. Okay, so the Arboretum, if we want to talk about the conceit, the extended metaphor of the book, the Arboretum is like a man-made Garden of Eden, and within this garden there can be things like romantic poetry, like a Wordsworth poem just celebrating a daisy, and there can be the idea of the immortality of the artist, because it, you know, it's paradise, it's immortal, it's eternal, and it's outside of the world, or it's a thing apart or something. And there's an important a word coined by somebody after the idea of pastoralism, which is that thing in literature where you go all the way back to the classics, where they're celebrating, you know, the shepherd leading, playing his flute, and just living this idyllic life in this paradise apart from the depravity of cities and culture and so. And so there's this romanticization of that, and that's pastoralism. And then there's post-pastoralism, which is looking at nature, but through the lenses that we can't help but have come upon of, you know, environmental degradation and the horrors of capitalism and the Holocaust and all these awful things that have kind of kicked us out of the garden of our innocence. And so in this case, we've been expelled from the Arboretum of poetry. And so in the second section, you'll see things like certain forbidden poems, forbidden Norfolk pine tree, and then their counterparts, which are the poem you can write about, the Norfolk pine, which has to go through those lenses and those screens, and they, you can't just write the innocent nature poem. And so that's one of the big themes of the book, another one is also, other ones have to do with democratization and technology and the kind of radical anonymity created by the saturation of the internet and the speed of the development of technology and the fragmentation of culture, and how strangely we're even in the midst of globalization kind of once again constrained to the local. Because, and it reminds me, I always think back to this Irish folk tale where there's a leprechaun and a guy who finds the gold, and he says to the leprechaun, okay, hang on, I'll be right back, I need a shovel so I can bury this gold. And he ties a ribbon around the tree, and he makes the leprechaun swear that he won't untie the ribbon. So he goes and gets his shovel, and 6 hours later he's back, and he just finds 1,000 trees with ribbons on them, And there it is, that beautiful irony that is captured in those kind of folk tales. And so, yeah, much in the same way, artists working in what is unarguably like an extraordinary movement in democratization that, for instance, has allowed me to go to grad school when I was an absolute shit student in undergrad. Like, it would truly be a crime for me to be going to grad school in an earlier generation. Like, someone would be very upset about that. But it totally changed my life because it just changed my trajectory completely. Mm. But anyway, yeah, so democratization is a big theme in it as well. Mm. Yeah, and there'll be other things I could go on and on, but
yeah,
I'm sure that'll do me.
I was really, I was just thinking about that shift in the book in the collection from that first section to the second section, and I was wondering a little bit about challenge, you know, and I don't mean that in a, you know, I don't mean that in a minimizing way or anything like that. I'm just wondering, those first sections often do call on poetical, maybe not form, but poetical theme and poetical. Is that a word, poetical? It sounds weird now that I'm saying it. But yeah, like it calls on sort of characters and places away from where I'm living now.
Yeah.
And when I moved into the second section, you know, we get a little bit of Paikokuriki, we get a little bit of, you know, polar bears and, yeah, you know, and I'm just wondering, can you talk a little bit about how those two things, you know, this idea of the pastoral and the, you know, the classic and the, you know, those things that sit so far away from an education that might happen in the 21st century.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, why engage those engines now? Like, I mean, I mean, I'm not challenging in any way, but wondering, cool. You know, like, I really enjoyed the way they sat together, and I'm just wondering, do you have any thoughts on that?
As I just mentioned, I was a really bad undergrad student. And I, you know, I really, like, just didn't read books. And I didn't read books growing up either, really. Like,
yeah,
a handful of books, really slowly. I was a bad student. Like, I grew up in a pretty anti-cultural kind of household. And that's just the way it is. It's, yeah, I was upset about this for a little while. And then I said, no, that's quite okay. So when I first moved to New Zealand, I just had a super kind of crisis of ignorance, and I'm like, oh, the light hit me coming out of Plato's cave or whatever, and I got quite unwell, and I was definitely not, you know, the best partner at the time, because I was so kind of pathologically, desperately trying to catch up and trying to claim what I thought was a right for any, or and a necessity for anyone who wanted to become, you know, a great artist or something, to be ambitious and to master all these things that I thought were necessary to master. And in a way, a lot of the value of reading certain things I've found over the years is not so much in, you know, being able to utilize them or facts like, oh, St. Augustine, oh, I've read St. Augustine. Like, it's much more about diffusing my own anxiety about ignorance of not knowing who the fuck St. Augustine is.
Totally, right? Like, know what you're talking about,
definitely some of the writing, because we're talking about 2008, and that's when I moved to New Zealand,
and
a lot of things were on my mind, and I was genuinely excited by them, like, and because I was such a shit student, I was not really capable of reading or studying or doing things I wasn't excited about, because I didn't have any, like, willpower, really. It was a mixture of anxiety and excitement. And so in that first section, you'll see things, right, the aging Western Roman Empire and the names of rivers and things. And it's a super fine line, and trust me, I've thought about it heaps, and much more so in the next couple books, I think, developed a much more precise way to deploy, you know, proper names and difficult words and things. And there's George Steiner, maybe, has that book on difficulty, mm-hmm. which has a few essays. And I think the first one has to do with he enumerates four orders of difficulty, and the lowest order of difficulty is just to do with referentiality, and then other ones, you know, get more complex. But the simple thing of typing in, for instance, there's the ancient river, the Borysthenes,
mm.
which is now the Dnieper, it's probably not that, but it's something. and if you Google it, if you Wikipedia it, you find out instantly what it is.
Mm.
I mean, it doesn't give you exactly the key, because you'd have to know a little bit about how the boundaries of the Western Roman Empire were kind of stable along the Danube, and they grew, and then they waned, and whatever. And I don't know that I can exactly justify using that word. It's a thorny issue. Whereas quite recently in writing about Cezanne, I found this definitive, exhaustive Cezanne online catalog,
mm-hmm.
and got it down to such a science that anytime I mention a painting, I put in the 3-digit code, which you can enter into the search field at this site and bring up exactly the painting
mm.
I mention, which I think is a really cool democratizing
mm.
capacity
yeah.
of the internet. Like, whereas you read about paintings in collections in the past, and maybe there's a, you know, ekphrastic works that talk about paintings, and you're like, wow, that's great. I didn't even know the title of this was a painting.
Yeah.
And now that someone told me, I'll have to look it up and see what I get. But like, yeah, there's that. And then there's this like note on the text, and this is on things like this book corresponds to this thing and this website. And you know, like, yeah. So it's been a real learning process for me in terms of working out just my feeling on, you know, the availability of all these references. And I often draw the line on it, like, well, if it can be Wikipedia'd and become intelligible within the first few lines of reading the Wikipedia entry,
mm.
or if it can be looked up in the dictionary, the online dictionary or whatever, then that's cool. And everyone, mostly, who's going to even bother reading my book, which is going to be fuck all people, will probably know how to use the search engine and can access these things.
Mm.
But then, you know, there's other ways of the book being difficult, which are different stories, but that's the one I think one can be responsible for and
mm.
try to attend to with the most easily. Yeah.
Mm, yeah. And like, I'm really taken by this idea of a self-directed education as well. I'm quite interested in that, because I know it really chimes with my own experience. Like, I sort of left school at 15, ended up at university at 21. It took me 10 years to do my undergraduate degree. You know, like, I managed to do an entire English degree without studying Shakespeare. You know, like, I just, and this growing, you know, like, last year I was really interested. I read a quote by Nietzsche and I got interested in that, and there's a library, and it just seems so important, doesn't it? And this idea of democratizing, you know, like, because I know that when I was reading this, I did have my phone in my hand and was looking up the odd thing, and it felt like, you know, like, there was a sound and a beauty, and there was an accessibility to the poem without the meaning.
Mm.
And these words have connotations in my mind as well. Like, if I see a Greek word, I feel a certain way, and, you know, like, but I just think it's so interesting the different ways I really like that idea about referentiality, like the way that we place ourselves in something we don't understand.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, exactly. You get certain feelings for words, like you might have seen it before, and the vaguest, most distant kind of neurological connections will give you some color of what you've read. And it took me a long time, having been a non-reader and then becoming one, to bother like really looking up words, which is vital, which I didn't realize was so vital. I would just be like, oh yeah, whatever. Every time I saw a word, I didn't, oh, whatever. Like, do the laziest kind of gloss over, like, thing to just bridge it to the next word. But when you do that, it's, as you say, it's a great form of self-education. And that's one of the ways I got so much more educated or whatever, just by looking up words I didn't know, which is so, it's so simple. But it also speaks to, yeah, well, you know, the absurdity of uni these days, and And like, you know, I went to uni and then I went to grad school. And even in grad school, although I worked really hard in my own way when I wasn't smoking pot or whatever, like, so I worked enough, I guess, but I still wasn't a particularly responsible or good student or anything. But, you know, I've dropped whatever, 40 grand or something in a US loan, which continues to grow and shadow me, and I just keep running away from it. And then, you know, a little bit of borrowed money to get by in Iowa. And yet, like, all those years combined, can't stand any light of day to the light of learning by myself in these last 8 years in New Zealand. And yeah, it's just, you know, I guess, you know, you need a certain amount of training or something to be able to access certain books or whatever, but just the library, I became so much less materialistic maybe as well. Like, I'm sure as a teenager I would have been like that loser who buys, like all good Americans, like buys an Ayn Rand, however you say that woman's
good,
name.
Good, yeah.
And it's like, I swear every bookshop you go into in the States has like a major feature of Rand. And I'm like, and it's no coincidence. Anyway, you buy that, or you buy Nietzsche, or you buy whatever you think is you're supposed to buy, and then you take it home and you read a little bit of it, and you're like, oh yeah, cool. And then it sits there and languishes, and that is that. But now I just mostly don't bother buying books. I just read them in the library and take notes. And anyway, not to belabor the point too much, but yes, self-education has been infinitely more fruitful for me than college, which I just wasn't prepared for. I just was not at all prepared for, or wasn't trained or set up to succeed in uni, and so I just didn't.
Because I think there's that other interesting thing, like I sort of, I'm the first person in my family ever to go to university, and you know, I grew up in a place where you know, like I felt like I needed some kind of authority, you know, I felt like I needed to go to university so that someone could tell me what is the right thing to know, kind of. But I was just thinking since, and I mean, that was a privilege, you know, I was very lucky to do that. But since sort of leaving that, there's such a different process of finding what I need for art, you know, in a way, you know, like it's such a, I don't know, I've just found it so interesting, like sort of coming across something and then you know, I suppose having the tools, which I'm really lucky for, but you know, then being able to search, you know, it's a different kind of research. It's a very different kind of research. It's quite wild.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's great. It's the best. You know, there's no deadlines.
Yes.
No pressure.
No one's gonna mark me with an A or a B.
Exactly right. Exactly.
You talked a little bit about you know, it being hard to publish this sort of work, and I wonder why do you think that is? Like, do you have any opinions on that?
It's been hard to publish here in New Zealand, and I've also been trying in the States as well. And they're two different ways of being published for one thing. Like, in the States, basically the only way is just to send out to contests. So there's screeds of contests. And, you know, screeds of manuscripts being sent to these screeds of contests. And you know, you just, whoever you are, especially if you're doing anything even a little different, it's going to be really hard to get past those, even those, like, sub-editors who are calling it for the proper judges. And sometimes, and because there's, like, a million poets in the States, or a million people graduating with MFAs and all this. Maybe not a million, but like,
I'm gonna say a million.
A squillion. Maybe even a squillion.
A squillion. I think that's even better. The squillions.
And then you look at the judge and you're like, oh, well, who's judging this contest? And then you read the stuff and you're like, oh, wow. That's one, it's kind of rubbish. And two, that person's definitely not gonna like what I'm doing. And three, they're probably not even gonna get it, because the person who's gonna vet it first is probably not gonna like it either.
Yeah.
And I brought with me a really helpful email from Steve Toussaint, and I don't think he would mind me reading it. Because Steve is like a really awesome poetry scholar, and he knows everything, and like, he's been really kind to me in helping me to, you know, to come to terms and to understand and different things happening in American poetry, and in poetry full stop, and it's largely due to Steve and time and Therese Lloyd that I've overcome my anxiety about these things. But he outlines, and I only thought to read this, even though it's a little long, because I think it would be so helpful for
people. It would be amazing. It's so
interesting.
Please do. That's so generous. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve. And sorry. So I was asking Steve what the main streams are in American poetry, what the schools or movements are. And Steve, you know, has a few caveats, like, this is, you know, these are my impressions. Yeah, don't take them for gospel or whatever. But, of course, he says great things. Anyway, here we go. So this is directly from Steve's email. Anyway, as I see it, the dominant aesthetic conversations happening at the moment revolve around the place of tradition, the place of identity, and the place of aesthetics in current writing. On one extreme, the conceptual movement is shaking things up considerably. The big names here are Kenneth Goldsmith, Vanessa Place, Robert Fitterman, and Craig Dworkin. Their militant stance against lyric, expression, and originality make them easy to dismiss, but equally difficult to ignore. Their more playful, ironic cousin is Flarf, K.S. Muhammad, Gary Sullivan, Kate DeGentesh, etc. Together with some remnants and reincarnations of language poetry, they seem to constitute the only real avant-garde anymore, coupling formal concerns with political militarism, though some recent articles about them, look at Amy King's writing about it online, suggest a far more dubious political ideology supporting their efforts. Plus, they seem entrenched at UPenn, University of Pennsylvania, which seems to counteract claims of counterculture. Diametrically opposed would be what I see as the Ashbury Club, Timothy Donnelly, Robin Schiff, Ben Lerner, to a lesser extent Jeffrey G. O'Brien, who have made technical proficiency and lyric expansiveness cool again. In my final year at Iowa, O'Brien taught and pulled a number of my classmates on board this train. Their popularity is evidenced in their high-profile publications, Boston Review, Wave Books, overseas publications with the likes of Picador and Faber, and their mass appeal in the MFA. There is a more tacit appreciation for traditional poetry and poetic forms with these guys, while still being clear children of postmodernity, seen in Lerner's disjunctive play and O'Brien's Marxism. Reading them, I often get the feeling that they are saying, I know how to write a perfect ballada. I just don't want to, but you know I could if I did. I appreciate the commitment to craft and formal integrity, but I am a little perplexed at the range of their influence and the cult of dudeness that seems to precede them. Then there are the funny poets. You and I have discussed before. Journals like Forklift Ohio and presses like Octopus are really heavy into names like Matt Hart, Amanda Nadelberg, Zachary Schomburg, Mark Leidner, etc. It's all New York school, and it's all New York school all the time. This is reductive, but by far it seems the most prevalent kind of work coming out of MFAs, and UMass in particular. Hipster poetry, because each poem comes out wearing a mustache and sculling a PBR. Then there's the growing cult of the grotesque, led by Johan Goransson, his wife Joyelle McSweeney, and their press Action, yes, a kind of belated surrealism, using words like kitsch, necro, and other fun low art cliches. An anthology emerges from this each year. Emerged from it a few years back called The Girlesque, which feminized the program. I get tired of how all their critical engagements seem to hinge on simply reversing normal standards of value. You think poems should be good? What's so good about good? We want poetry to be bad. Excess is the calling card here. It seems to me like a revamped, dig-out kind of confessional poetry. Hey, I'm really sorry, Steve. I might be plunging into... Yeah, anyway, I know you'll forgive me, so it's okay, thanks. And we're getting toward the end here. Another trend is spelled out in Stephen Burt's essay, The New Thing, which discusses a number of poets who are reworking some of the aesthetic preoccupations of modernism, objectivism in particular. He names Joseph Massey and Peter O'Leary among them, and the presses, The Cultural Society, and Flood Editions. I've been sympathetic to the work of a lot of these poets, as they seem to get closer to my own preoccupations, sound, minimalism, spirituality, and craft. Precursors would be William Zukofsky, but also Duncan, Susan Howe, Taggart. It's a kind of remodernism, and seems totally uncool in the grand scheme. Its effects are quiet, not overtly political, and its primary practitioners are aging white men. And he goes on to discuss kind of the catch-all category that I won't go into. But so yeah, it's an amazing a review of the things going on in American poetry, and which I had maybe unformed, incoherent ideas about, but totally recognized as things. And I'd say in America, I really don't belong to those groups. And in New Zealand, I really don't belong to the New Zealand thing. And so, yeah, that's why I've had a hard time publishing.
Yeah.
So thanks for that answer. 80% is due to you, Toussaint. Good on you, Steve.
When you were at Iowa, did you fit more comfortably into some of those? Did you fit... Was there a degree of comfort? Was your work more comfortable there? Or?
Well, I feel lucky to say that. I had some really people I really admired who respected me, and especially because I was one of the, like, two-thirds of the people who go there, like Ivy League people, and people well-educated and well-raised and all that, and I was definitely in the other side of the tracks camp, but nonetheless was still kind of embraced, which was really cool, and I didn't have a crisis then because I was just having so much fun, and it was great, I think it's like somebody who teaches themselves guitar but doesn't look at a chord book or anything, just like fiddles around for hours and hours making something that might be aesthetically really honed. Like, I honed my aesthetic to no end without gaining any knowledge except for a pure detached kind of aesthetic, which served me later on, but like at the time I was like, just making these, you know, guitar compositions, if you like, to carry that metaphor on, and that had no bearing with musical theory, and yet nonetheless might have been kind of cool.
I so relate. I was just thinking, I think I saw you last Christmas when I finished Moby Dick. Like, totally relate to that anxiety, you know, like, it was, I just felt like I couldn't, because I was writing a book about the sea and about the animals that live in the sea, I just thought, I just cannot write that book if I haven't read Moby Dick, you know, and I was just thinking, I so relate to that idea of noodling away, you know, because I think that's what I did for years, I just noodled away, and that was fine, but it could only get me so far, I think.
I reckon Jack Spicer, whose name you might have come across, he had this great thing. He was always talked about being a medium, and the Martians were the ones writing the poems. And he, you know, when forced to, he would admit, like, that different ages call these different things, like the muses and the subconscious and all the rest. But he said something quite pithy that I remember, and I don't remember much of anything. But he was like, you know, the aliens or the Martians or whatever can, you know, they go into your mind, into that room, and arrange things and do whatever and make the thing, and then it comes out of you. But it always helps to have more furniture in the room.
Oh, that is brilliant.
Totally true, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And he's speaking to directly to the, you know, to ignorance and whatever. And so when I got his collected, his collected was reprinted a few years ago, this great publication called My Vocabulary Did This to Me, I think that's what it's called. And he has, in the middle, he has this, because he ran a course in San Francisco, I think. I'll never remember the name of it, but of course Duncan was there, and heaps, and I think he took the course, and heaps of cool people. But he had this kind of test, this exam that you had to pass to get into his course, and it would list like Augustine, Buddha, Jesus, and like lots of other figures, great or important figures in history, and all kinds of other people. And it required so much knowledge, and I'm like, and I felt so angry when I didn't pass it, and I'm like, but I could make a good poem, like, I don't know any of this, and I really want to know, and it's not my fault, and anyway, I haven't, although I might take the quiz again at some stage, I haven't bothered looking back, because it's no longer the kind of painful thing that it was for me. But yeah, furniture.
I love that idea of furniture, because I think that's the thing, like, you know, like, it's not until I started making those utterances out in the world, like, you know, I would read something and someone would say to me, oh, that's quite a lot like, and I'd be like, oh, shit, you know, like, I've never heard of that, what is that about, you know, I have no idea who that is, that's just wild. Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah.
Who's publishing this?
Oh, it's, well... I can tell you some things about it. I'm not at liberty to tell you the person behind it, because they've asked me to keep it secret. They wish to remain they, that lovely pronoun that we use for a non-sexed individual. They asked me to keep their identity secret. And if you go to, but it's Fur Press,
yep.
Faith in Readers Press. And it's based on this idea, like, I'll admit, I had to conjure up this Facebook page because this person didn't know how to use Facebook, which is fair enough. And I must admit, I know how to use Facebook. And so he or she wished to have the John Keats negative capability quote at the top, because this person thought that this was something lacking in New Zealand poetry, or New Zealand poetry publishing, this trust, this faith in readers. And so really briefly, what negative capability has come to mean, or at least partly, is the ability of the reader to engage in mystery or difficulty or what have you in a poem without struggling and bracing against it and like rejecting it because it's not immediately clear and transparent and prosy generally and maybe narrative.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the things that are that make a lot of poems really easy to access are not necessarily always going to be elements of poems that require of the reader some negative capability.
Mm.
And yeah, for me, don't get me wrong, I mean, I imagine that people who don't engage much in poetry have this idea that difficult poetry will be like what we call language poetry, which was a specific movement in the 60s and 70s, I guess, with lots of, you know, fragmentation and an attempt to reclaim language from the oppressors who abuse it, and so it has quite a political aim, and it's really difficult and really resists conventional meaning. And anyway, sometimes I imagine when people are like, oh, difficult poetry, that's that total nonsensical stuff that is utterly lifeless and heartless and not at all idiomatic and stupid or whatever, or like effectively not for me. Whereas, I mean, for instance, yeah, Stevens, Wallace Stevens, Anne Carson, Rilke, all these great writers can be really difficult, and they can do it in using really idiomatic language, and there's novelty, but it's a really beautiful, fresh, and not difficult for difficulty's sake kind of novelty.
Mm.
And I mean, Nabokov too is great, like, for that, and yeah, all kinds of people. And yeah, I mean, for one thing, I must admit I read less and less poetry these days, and I find myself much more comfortable reading like Calvino's Invisible Cities,
mm-hmm.
or like Pynchon, and other things that are this inhabit this amazing poetic prose kind of space. And yeah, so I have a really funny feeling about this book in some ways, like it's a part of it's a me from the past, just like some of your earlier books will be a Pip from the past, that you gain weird perspectives on because it's not exactly you anymore.
Mm.
It's only somewhat you. But yeah,
I've got this idea about difficult, like this difficult idea, because I think sometimes the things that we call difficult are actually really easy. Like, I was just thinking of language poetry, and I was thinking it's when I try to make sense of it that it's difficult. It's like me saying, it's a preconceived idea, maybe?
Yeah, that's a really important point. Like, you're exactly right. Sorry, I don't think I even actually fully got to what negative capability is, or maybe, but you're pointing directly to it.
Is that what negative capability is?
Yeah,
because I always think I understand it, but then I realize I don't understand it.
And the point is that there is the best poetry can't be paraphrased or reduced into XYZ. You can't reduce it to the sum of its devices, its poetic devices. And so, right, like a lot of people also like I mean, this is how we're taught really in high school. You kind of thought, like, this is a poem. Here's how we decode it. This is what it means.
Yep.
And Bob's your uncle. Yep. Like, and, you know, then the pedagogy has changed about that a lot, I think. Well, maybe not in high school. Maybe that's still how poetry happens, or if it happens at all. But, Wallace Stevens, I brought this poem with me.
Oh, yeah. Where's Wallace Stevens? We've got papers. Papers on the couch. Ah, here's Wallace Stevens.
Here we go.
Yay.
And
would you be willing to read it?
Yeah, absolutely.
That'd be so great.
It's musical. It's musical, which is something that's really important for me. Music, as it is for Steve, and lots of people, obviously. But Stevens is nothing if not musical.
Mm.
He's idiomatic. You can follow it in real time, like unlike maybe certain modernist texts like Joyce or Pound or whatever, where you have to address a kind of companion and stuff, and it's much more of a three-dimensional study effort. But this moves along
Is it chronologically?
Chronologically?
I just said it wrong.
Chronially?
Is it chronologically? I know it's what you mean. Chronological. There you go. It sings like it's like Frank Sinatra. Good God. Michael Bublé, maybe. I don't know.
But so musical, idiomatic, language you'll understand, and yet still complex and beautiful and kind of inexhaustible, I think.
Mm.
And that's what I look for in poetry. Anyway, have a drink. This is a very famous Stevens poem called The Idea of Order at Key West. She sang beyond the genius of the sea. The water never formed to mind or voice like a body, holy body, fluttering its empty sleeves. And yet its mimic motion made constant cry, caused constantly a cry that was not ours, although we understood, inhuman, of the veritable ocean. The sea was not a mask, no more was she. The song and water were not medleyed sound, even if what she sang was what she heard, since what she sang was uttered word by word. It may be that in all her phrases stirred the grinding water and the gasping wind, but it was she and not the sea we heard. For she was the maker of the song she sang. The ever-hooded, tragic-gestured sea was merely a place by which she walked to sing. Whose spirit is this, we said, because we knew it was a spirit that we sought and knew that we should ask this often as she sang. If it was only the dark voice of the sea that rose, or even colored by many waves, if it was only the outer voice of sky and cloud, of the sunken coral water-walled, however clear, it would have been deep air, the heaving speech of air, a summer sound repeated in a summer without end, and sound alone. But it was more than that, more even than her voice and ours, among the meaningless plungings of water and the wind, theatrical distances, bronze shadows heaped on high horizons, mountainous atmospheres of sky and sea. It was her voice that made the sky acutest at its vanishing. She measured to the hour its solitude. She was a single artificer of the world in which she sang, and when she sang, the sea, whatever self it had, became the self that was her song, for she was the maker. Then we, as we beheld her striding there alone, knew that there never was a world for her, except the one she sang and, singing, made. Ramon Fernandez, tell me, if you know, why, when the singing ended and we turned toward the town, tell why the glassy lights, the lights in the fishing boats at anchor there, as the night descended, tilting in the air, mastered the night and portioned out the sea, fixing in blazoned zones and fiery poles, arranging, deepening, enchanting night. Oh, blessed rage for order, pale Ramon, the maker's rage to order words of the sea, words of the fragrant portals dimly starred, and of ourselves and of our origins in ghostlier demarcations. Keener sounds.
Man.
Yeah.
It's just magnificent. It's
magnificent. And this is what, you know, will have been like the 83rd time I've read it. And I feel now like I know, I understand it less than I did last time, and maybe last time a bit more than the time before that. And it's just this, yeah, it's inexhaustible. Like, you could read Autobiography of Red 100 times.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful, and the narrative is understandable and all that, but there's nothing you can't deduce it reduce it to any fundamental elements. You can't just say, oh, this is why this succeeds as this brilliant immortal work. Like, it's just great and beautiful and novel and strong and classic and all these good things.
It just hits something, and I mean, that sounds so lame, but you know what I mean? Like, it just, I think now words fail me, which is exactly your point.
Yeah.
I can't say I like that because, oh God, it was just so fantastic. Can we talk a little bit, just sort of thinking about Stevens, you know, like, I always have this image of him surrounded by a group of people, you know, and I just wonder, you know, like, sometimes when we're working in these newer ways, we sort of, or different ways or whatever the word is, you know, like, we don't have these sort of writer soulmates, you know what I mean? Like, you know, like, I was just wondering, in New Zealand, you know, there's Steve, and then Therese Lloyd's work is amazing as well. I just wonder, is there, yeah, like, I mean, what am I trying to say? Yeah, like, are there people that you sort of surround yourself and bounce ideas off, or, you know, that community? I always think Iowa sort of is this community, then you come out here and,
yeah.
Are there people that you, you know, like, talk to and stuff like that?
There are, and it took a while.
Mm.
I mean, it took some time. I mean, it took a while, especially because in the first few years I was here, I was just quite monkish about it.
Mm-hmm,
But, yeah, I mean, Therese, who was my partner and who's now my best friend in the world, and is definitely one of the most underrated, very powerful writers and thinkers. I mean, she's got such a brilliant instinct, and she continues to this day. Like, last weekend, she looked at my Cezanne stuff, and she said exactly all the things that I couldn't see instantly. So Therese is a great reader and a great writer. And that's great. And we don't really write similar things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I massively admire a lot of things she does, but it's not stuff that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. You know, there'll be some overlap naturally enough. But let's say, like, a list of people I really admire for one reason or another, because I like their poetry. I mean, this applies to all these people. I like their poetry. And some more and some less do similar or, like, harmonious things, I'd say, are like poetry makers, as it were. And some of them are really great poetry activists, as it were. Like Helen Rickaby, I have infinite respect. She's easily, far and away, the single, I think, most important activating poetry figure in Wellington, in New Zealand. I mean, she's not just someone who supports poetry blindly. She's really smart. She's a really good poet. She's really awesome. I love Helen Rickaby.
Me too.
Other people, Anne Kennedy is great. Yep. John Newton is great. Anna Jackson is great. These people also read at Pegasus, which makes me infinitely happy. Hera is great. Greg Kahn, Chris Holdaway. I think those are my people.
Mm.
And I couldn't say that any of them are, oh, I don't know. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's just my own point of view, but I feel a bit, I don't know, a bit askew from all these people, even though I love their work and who they are and what they're doing. Even so, I still feel, a bit off in the field, looking at the sky and doing something weird and not quite sure what it is. But actually, you talked about Stevens and Stevens and Cezanne, for that matter, were both kind of, I don't think aloof is the word, but kind of askew from what was going on.
Yeah.
Like, Cezanne was such a weirdo, and he just didn't make it in Paris. Like, no, he couldn't do it. He didn't like it. They didn't like him. And it sounds directly like I'm comparing myself to Cezanne or whatever. I just like Cezanne, and I happen to, you know, feel there's heaps of people who are alienated in the world, and it's totally, they don't have to pretend they're being Cezanne. But Stevens, what a weirdo. He was just working as that insurance company president.
Yeah.
5 days a week, he's just writing on the weekends, I guess, and he walked like 40 miles a day or something, and he was such a quiet man. And there's those great anecdotes, like somebody would be like, oh, Wallace writes poetry.
Oh, yeah.
Poppycock. Like, nobody would have, nobody knew, because he was such a quiet, intense weirdo. And yeah, and maybe because, I mean, I guess maybe he would have, I mean, look, I know fuck all in general, but maybe he achieved more success, say, than Cezanne did or something, but he certainly wasn't, like, riding the waves of veneration or whatever. I think he was truly askew for, like, most of it, yeah.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about, like, thinking about that job at the insurance agent. When I first met you, you were working at the library at university.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and I remember during that time, I think both of us always had a book in our hands that we were reading or, you know, that sort of thing. And now you work at Pegasus Books.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about, and you also put on readings at Pegasus Books as well. Like, do you want to talk a little bit about that space and what it is to, you know, what it is to have a space like that, which is, you know, it feels a little bit askew to everything in itself, you know what I mean? Like, we have this secondhand bookshop loaded to the gunnels with books, you know, the most beautiful place you ever want to be. You just want to be there all the time,
yeah.
And you get to be there. And yeah, like, not sort of Amazon, not, you know, all that sort of stuff, but also not one of the big chains and not one of the independent. Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about what it's like to work around that?
Yeah, it's so cool. It's dangerously cool because whereas in the library, I was fighting tooth and nail to be reading the whole time. I was going to be goddamned if someone was going to take a minute of my time, my fucking precious time, like, doing something mundane and stupid. And so, like, even when I started really getting in trouble for just reading PDFs, that I would stand up, photocopy, like, scan, like, 20 pages in, go back to my seat and fucking read it on the screen. Eventually, I got so careless about it that, and, like, so blasé that I started getting in trouble. And then that's when I got into audiobooks, and I was sitting there listening to my audiobook and making the vaguest motions on the screen of things I'm meant to be doing or whatever. So, and it's, you know, it's stressful. It was a bit of work, like, having to do, because...
Sorry, I'm just imagining you need to write a book that is how to read at work. Yeah. There's your $1 million. No.
That, right? Yeah. But the thing, the reason it's dangerous at Pegasus is because I love the place so much and I care about people finding books because I want to find books.
Mm.
And I care about the collection because it's an awesome, idealistic collection put together by people who really love to read, which I'm sure you would understand. There are a lot of different factors that go into making the Vic Uni Libraries collection, and not that many people there like to read.
Like, yeah, yeah, totally.
And like 3 or 4 or whatever, 5 years ago or something, when that big restructure thing happened, or like the big building project at the Hub, which is, you know, a beautiful architectural marvel.
An airport.
Exactly.
Or a mall.
Yeah, all these things together. But there was a corresponding, like, shit show happening at the library, and it became super corporate, and that's when everything turned red, and there was all this tiered service and decentralized kind of nonsense. Just this major, massive corporate apparatus laying over what was originally a place for misfits and people who liked reading and, like, just weirdos to do work as it came, and then to, you know, just do whatever. And then suddenly it came, like, time to lean, time to clean land, and that's when I started getting militantly possessive about my time or whatever. But yeah, so anyway, in short, at Pegasus I expend a lot of my type A energies or whatever goes into making the place nice and making it and optimizing it, and I love it. I love its aesthetic, and I love the dudes who work there. And it is, as Hera once pointed out to me, very, very truly, like a sausage fest. And the three, well, four dudes away. My friend Greg Taylor works there a couple of days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Greg, one of my dearest friends in the world. But yeah, those three dudes are fucking weird. They're weird, weird people. They're lovely people, and if they were. And they're mostly really easy to work with. Otherwise, like, because the people you work with is always 98% of the equation is working with cool people. And if not, if they're not cool, if they cross the threshold or whatever the capacity, or whatever I'm trying to say, of not being cool, then it just stresses you out, and you go home and you start dreading work, going to work and all that. But this is by far the best job I've had, and I really love the guys that work there, and I love the shop, and I love the people who come in, and I fizz about what people are getting. And if I see someone climbing the ladder in the criticism section, which is such an underutilized ladder, I just stare at them, looking at what they're looking. I'm like, I'm that weird voyeurist, fucking looking at things in the shop, and it genuinely gives me like euphoria, which makes me nervous or a little upset or afraid or something, because I've always had this attitude toward jobs, and like, they're just a means to an end, and fuck jobs. And I've always had shitty hospo jobs, especially in the States, waiting tables and having people shit on me all the time. And now to be in this job is, yeah, it's super lucky. And to speak to the readings, Ridian Thomas, an excellent writer himself and a dear man to me. I don't get to see him much anymore because he's super busy. I mean, he's an awesome writer. His book's coming out in a month or something, real soon, with Lawrence and Gibson, which is awesome. And he's read from it. I've heard him read from it two times at Pegasus, and it's really good. But Ridian was totally the one, because he was before Simon Polensky, who was my predecessor and the kind person who put me forward for that position. Before him was Ridian. Ridian might have come before that, but whatever. Anyway, Ridian was coming back from Europe, and just when I was starting to work there, and he and John, who's unbelievably generous, was just giving him all these odd jobs to do while he was working out what he was going to do for a job. And so it was cool, because then I got to really know Ridian, and he's such an awesome dude. And he was like, hey, you know, we should have a reading. And I'm like, yeah, cool, reading, cool. And Ridian totally had the energy to do it, and I was into it, but I thought it was just going to be a one-off. And I'm like, yeah, that was cool. And he's like, no, we should really make it a thing. And I'm like, yeah, cool. why don't you do that. Like, I'm totally on board. And then, yeah, so Ridian was really the power and the force behind it. And then slowly when it, you know, we had done four or five or six, and it started getting really awesome. And I was like, this is great. And, you know, we were collaborating and working out who we were going to get. And, you know, not long after Ridian got his job with the Greens I won't know the chronology exactly, but yeah, Ridian started doing that and going hard on his book. And so, like, yeah, he became less available. But by that time, I got my own wings. And it just became an increasingly idealistic, cool thing. And there's no affiliations. You could have whoever you want read. It's just an expression of idealism in an ideal space, in an ideal place. And it's just super fun. And I'm so appreciative of the people who read. And yeah, it's just good times all around.
I just love it there so much. Like, I mean, there's something so nice about going in there, and often they're on a Friday night, and the city's super busy, and you get to sort of get that energy as well, and then you just pop in. And I really love the way the bookshop keeps working around you. You know, like, even though the readings are on, there are often people looking for books. I remember going to one, and someone came into the, you know, and was like looking for their book and found their book, and yeah, it's just so great. And like you say, I feel like it's always a surprising lineup, you know, like it's always the people that a week before I'd been saying, oh, I wish I could see those people read more often, you know, like it's just so great. And often quite a good sort of difference even in the night, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, which I think just works so well. It's so awesome. I'm going to finish with one last question, I think. I don't know, who knows? We'll probably talk for another hour. But I'm just wondering, I was very interested in what you were saying about reading less and less poetry. And I'm just wondering, why was it poetry to begin with?
Yeah.
Like, how did you stumble onto that? And why does it remain to be poetry? Or does it remain to be poetry? Like, I guess, yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. Well, it's that funny, mysterious thing that there's a certain amount of cultural absorption of poetry, and you learn it a bit in school, so it's like So you're not in a vacuum. It's not like you just come up with poetry out of nothing.
Mm.
But it, to this day, I find it an incredibly mysterious thing that so many kids, like, you know, even the littlest kids, you know, playing with language. And, you know, you, it's so often the amazing associative leaps and perceptions, like, even more profound than Lewis Carroll, that are happening in children because they're not socialized and normativized, and language isn't, and all these developmental things are not quite as ossified, or whatever you want to say, and regulated, and so they have these great mental leaps. And I would have written a little bit now and again as a kid, but it was only when I was maybe 16 or something. And again, this is one of these apocryphal, it's not apocryphal, it really happened, but it's not exactly, it's not a proud moment, but I feel like the first poem I could really remember just doing on my own and not as an assignment was seeing something on a school desk, and it was this super melodramatic poem about a breakup or whatever it was, with like tears watering weeds of lies and things like that.
I have one just over there. I found one of mine from 16 years old. Why did you leave? Yeah, it's
And I had to make fun of it. I had to write, which is not a nice impulse. I'm not proud of my impulse being like, yeah, now I've got to write next to this thing, this parody of this, like, which if that person who sat at that desk and presumably sat there again would have seen, would have been insulting. Anyway, let's just leave that to childhood and say this is what kids or teenagers do or something. I don't know. But I took off from there, and I wasn't parodying anymore, but I was writing, like, rhyming poems about, for instance, the expulsion of the light brown M&M.
Yes.
When that happened, and it was replaced by the garish blue M&M,
mm.
which was still later to be followed by purple and pink, I think, as well. Or maybe there was a contest, vote for which one you want, the blue, the purple, or the pink. Anyway, blue won, but it was at the expense of the light brown, which was always the subtlest color, because you get the dark brown.
Mm.
You know, the green was great as well. It's such a beautiful, pure kind of green. But that light brown, so gorgeous and so au naturel, and its juxtaposition with the dark brown and the other colors, the autumnal colors of M&Ms, it was just so right. And when they fucking took it out and put the blue in, and I was so upset, and I wrote this long, long, like, ABAB rhyme scheme poem, and on an overnight trip with the Boy Scouts, like, I read it out to everybody, and who, God knows what these people thought then, but I thought I was so chuffed, and people were, you know, laughed and thought it was cool, and probably if I read out something serious, it would have been completely inappropriate, but because it was funny, I guess it was okay to do, and then this kind of, like, slowly grew into my role, and then when I was a senior in high school, I started making, not necessarily serious, it was never really about expressing emotions or something, it was quite oblique, I think, but I started playing around with aesthetics and started, like, just very instinctively working out what I liked with words and colors and aesthetic things, and I think that's how a lot of people begin, is just, I mean, you know, you can begin writing about your emotions, and these are not mutually exclusive things, but, like, working out why words are cool, mostly not consciously, just like writing things and maybe mimicking things and maybe being super ignorant like me and just writing whatever. Anyway, so that eventually developed, and in uni, I went to uni and was a really bad uni student and wrote a poem every 6 months or something.
Mm-hmm.
But when I finally was crawling across the finish line of uni, I started doing a bit more seriously and then went back to the workforce after uni, found that it was miserable, waiting tables and doing shitty things and making poor life decisions. And then I applied for Iowa and all these other places, some of which I promise I won't extend this to. There's one funny thing where I was applying to, I think, UMass or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like the deadline was like an hour and a half away, and I was completely stoned and drunk, I think. And I copied and pasted my, like, admission or my, like, personal statement, whatever, into the field in the application. And I saw it was addressing Iowa, And I'm like, ha ha, wouldn't it be funny if I was so stoned that I forgot to change it to... And of course, I totally forgot. And then I wrote a groveling email. Anyway, in short, I didn't get in anywhere except for Iowa. Just because it's such a crapshoot. It doesn't, like, it's so not really a meritocracy.
Yeah.
Like, not in a straightforward kind of... It's really weird. And it's an extraordinary miracle of democratization and whatever else that I got there. And then... changed my trajectory completely there, but now it's, now I don't know if it's poetry anymore, because you know this Arboretum is definitively all poetry, and which makes me feel a little bit weird, because the second book was totally a back and forth between poetry and prose and other things like a play and stuff like that, and then the Cezanne stuff is just these little prose blocks, some of which are more or less modeled off of Van Carson's short talks, I don't find it a hugely useful distinction, poetry and prose. I mean, it's well and truly a spectrum, and I've always been a strong believer in form coming out of content, or them being co-inceptive or whatever, and that to try is to do as many different things as possible, because if you're writing, say, you know, like a kind of bleak scene about smallpox devastating a Canadian village where these Jesuit French missionaries are like trying to help the people, and it's such a kind of, I don't know, a kind of like bleak Russian thing, and it seemed to me when I was trying to write that the only proper way to do it was in prose, and there was not going to be certain like expositional things that would just be too clumsy in poetry. And on the other side, when I was writing the other side of that scene, which was from the perspective of smallpox, it seemed that a pantomim with these interlocking repetitive kind of systematic self-replication kind of qualities was exactly appropriate for addressing that content of the perspective of smallpox. And so yeah, like cultivating a capacity for doing anything along that spectrum, and then whatever is dictated by the subject matter, or to be able to express it in the way it should come out naturally or something, and not forcing it into poetry. Like, and so I'm hoping I'll be able to write poetry as such again, because maybe I'm just eliminating more and more things that I can do until I'm just can't do anything, and like don't like anything, and I don't read, and I don't write, and I hate it all because it's all done. But yeah, I don't know what the future is, but yeah.
I so love this idea. I mean, like, it's really nice. I get to teach some people who are often, they often are asking about, you know, what is a poem, what is prose, what is, you know, and I just find it so, you know, more and more I find myself saying to them, well, you know, like, names are names, you know, like, I mean, how does it feel, you know, like, and the, you know, a lot of the people that I teach in this particular place, you know, a lot of them are, they're very into poetry, like, poetry is what they want to write, and it's really interesting to, we sometimes do an exercise where you write till the end of the page, you know, like no line breaks, you know, put your, insert your rhymes inside, lots of rhyming, good rhyming poetry. And like, I don't know, like there is this way of kind of breaking. Yeah, because I think it goes the other way as well. I think there's prose writers that are, I don't know. Someone said to me the other day that I read a lot of poetry. And I was just thinking, doesn't everybody? And yeah, it was quite weird. Anyway, I don't know. Blah. I sound like I'm blowing my own trumpet. I read poetry.
That's great.
Would you be willing to finish off by reading a poem from Arboretum?
Yeah, for sure.
What would you like to read?
Thanks. That's
it's
good.
Such a magnificent work, by the way. Aww. I didn't say that. I just spent such an enjoyable... I read it all in one reading and one sitting, It was just... I don't know. It just blew my mind.
Oh, thanks, Pip. That's...
You're awesome, Lee.
You're awesome.
You're awesome. Yeah, so what are you going to read for us?
I'm going to read something from that second section with that, that central kind of theme of the Arboretum itself. And... so this has a forbidden apple tree. So that's the title of this poem, is A Forbidden Apple Tree. And this probably is the oldest poem in the book. And it was one of the things that was kind of, I guess, rejected
mm-hmm.
by my friend. And then it found its way into the book by virtue of being rejected, because it's the thing I can't write. Like, you can't write this, here it is.
Yeah.
And it's a Sestina, which you'll see has repeating end words. Forbidden apple tree. Under the apple tree, shrine to the moment when living fruit from life drops into watery sunshine's maternal grass, through the days that sleepwalk privately past, Adam holds the apple in his hand, detached, a quark of his knowing and of his fingers knowing. The solid red gesture holds the moment like a day in the hand, palpable as an apple dropped in the childish fields of his past. Plucking an apple takes him to that grass, the same and yet not the same grass, fingers pressed against their knowing stained glass of the church of the past, to see if only for the moment it takes a heart to drop the apple he holds in his hand. Such rich heat bloods a hand feeling for access among roots and grass. From Adam's hand countless apples drop into an underground pool of his knowing, touching off concentric longings for this moment he knows can't last, obsesses over its passing until it's past. He weighs the emerald hills, apple in hand, childhood reduced to a few thick moments, like trees among countless blades of grass, trying to force a knowing made clear through the lens of a teardrop, hoping for the sorry help of a raindrop as the afternoon sinks into the past. If he could live in a place of unknowing, like a bird, always with the wind at hand, or a dog, deep inside the grass, happy in a tessellation of moments, he would drop the apple in the grass, handing it over to the lifeless past, knowing it was only a moment.
Oh, such a great reading. Thank you so much. So, the most important thing I think people can do is find the website for Faith and Readers, eh?
Yeah.
So that would be on Facebook.
It is Faith. Facebook.
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 We should start. Oh, no. Okay, sorry. Yeah, I'm coming up with ideas. Sorry, yeah. So.
Yeah, if you just type in Fir Press.
F-I-R.
F-I-R Press, yep. Like the tree. I'm pretty sure it'll get you there.
Comes up for me. We'll put a link on. I'll put a link on the show page as well, which is betterreadnz.wordpress.com. So we'll go there, and then get to the opening, which the launch, which is Monday, 17th of October, 17 Tory Street at 6 p.m. And will people be able to get copies of this book through Fir if they're not in Wellington?
Maybe. Well, so it was just originally going to be like stapled A4 pages, and then my friends were like, no, you should really have like at least some kind of minimal quality book. I'm like, okay. And then I asked the person behind Fir Press, would this offend your ideals if we actually made something of a if I spent a week's wages on making 50-60 copies, which is what I made, like 60 copies through Murdoch Stevens.
Yay, Murdoch. Amazing. Crikey. Amazing man.
Dude. He's
keeping us afloat.
He's keeping us afloat.
He's keeping Wellington literature afloat. Go Murdoch.
Yeah, so they'll be on offer for free at the reading. And so, you know, it's vaguely possible that it's more than possible there'll be some left over, which I can send out. But if there's not... you know, I could always send the PDF or something.
Hey, that sounds great. I must admit that it was quite a nice feeling. I actually read it through on the PDF, and
oh, really?
I don't know. Like, I mean, it'll be awesome to have a book as well, but I don't know. I'm liking this democratization.
Yeah.
It's the best. Hey, thank you so much, Lee.
Oh, thank you,
Pip. God, it's just been magnificent talking to you.
Your same great questions.
Oh, yes. Hey, thanks, Eve.